Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the April 21st edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is What Comes After DEI by Emma Green. Annals of Higher Education, What Comes After DEI, colleges around the country in the face of legal and political backlash to their diversity programs are pivoting to an alternative framework known as pluralism. By Emma Green. A couple of weeks after President Donald Trump was reelected, a group of college presidents gathered for an event at the Penn Club, a stately building with wood-paneled rooms in Midtown Manhattan. Over drinks, Tanya Tetlow, the president of Fordham University in New York, told me about another college president whom she had become friends with after taking her role in 2022. The president confided to Tetlow that every morning they would lie in bed wishing they had cancer so they wouldn't have to go to work. We spoke about the difficult experiences of university leaders over the past year and a half, calling the cops on protesters, getting hauled before Congress, protecting students who felt scared of one another. To be held personally and professionally responsible for the behavior of 10,000 students is deeply unfair, Tetlow said. Though conservative critics of higher education claim that universities indoctrinate students to adopt leftist attitudes, several presidents told me that students arrive on campus already formed. They're not tabula rasa, Rich Lyons, the chancellor of UC Berkeley, said. Young people have faced economic hardship, he added, tend to bring with them hardened perspectives and a significant degree of anger. At Berkeley's commencement last spring, pro-Palestinian protesters disrupted the speakers, including the former chancellor, Carol Christ, who said sadly from the podium, "We have lost the ability to talk with one another." Lyons and the president at the Penn Club were grappling with the same question. How could they reach a wildly diverse set of students and teach them to engage with people who think differently than they do? Several of the presidents talked about initiatives they've rolled out to encourage civil debate. Incoming students at William & Mary go through a Better Arguments program, in which they are instructed, for instance, to prize maintaining relationships over winning a dispute. Arizona State University has a slew of centers designed to foster democratic habits, civic literacy, the exercise of free speech. Marlene Trump, the president of Boise State, said that when she took the job in 2019, the university was facing a lot of concern surrounding this narrative that higher ed only moved in one direction. There was only one set of ideas that were available. The school launched the Institute for Advancing American Values, which asked students and various speakers from different political backgrounds to describe the formative aspects of their lives and their most deeply held beliefs. Amid all the enthusiastic salesmanship for viewpoint, diversity, and civil disagreement, it was striking that most of the presidents studiously avoided the topic of diversity on campus, not just what ideas you have in the room, but also who you have in the room. Trump said that the Harvard scholar Danielle Allen was an intellectual inspiration for Boise State Center. Allen, who is Black, has written that colleges have gotten lost in the swamps of particular tenets of anti-racism as part of their embrace of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI. Conservatives have painted DEI as a uniform set of programs, ideas, and ideologies. In reality, the term encompasses a wide-ranging set of practices. Still, DEI spaces often share certain analytic frameworks, usually centering on questions of justice. How you make sure a specific subset of folks don't find themselves facing obstacles and barriers on campus, Allen said. Often in the DEI space, what we've done is to say Black compares to white compares to Asian. She added, that by definition is corrosive of community. Allen has advocated for an alternative intellectual framework that she describes as pluralism. The model aims to help students live and learn together, making everyone feel welcome, and also helping students navigate the conflicts that inevitably arise in a community where people have different worldviews. Pluralism demands that conservative evangelicals who don't believe in same-sex marriage be welcomed to campus alongside gay students, and that political conservatives who oppose affirmative action have fruitful discussions with people of color. In 2018, Allen and a group of colleagues published a report suggesting that viewpoint diversity and free expression are crucial components of inclusion and belonging on university campuses. But it was a hard time to push for viewpoint diversity, with Trump in office and the nation on the cusp of a racial reckoning. Conversations about inclusion and belonging effectively became limited to race, gender, sexuality, and disability, Allen said. I've experienced some frustration, I will admit, as I watch that paradigm narrowing in the years post-George Floyd, she told me. All those identities matter, but what we need to do as a pluralistic society and as a pluralistic campuses is broader than that. Recently, the mood in higher ed has shifted from introspective to panicked. In March, the Department of Education warned 60 schools that they had potentially violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by allowing relentless anti-Semitic eruptions on their campuses. The DOE pulled $400 million in federal funds from Columbia University. In response, the university has reportedly pledged to overhaul its security protocols and review its Middle East studies programs. The Trump administration also froze $175 million in funding for the University of Pennsylvania for allowing Trenton's gender athletes to compete in women's sports. Other universities that depend heavily on federal money for scientific research, such as Johns Hopkins, have laid off workers and closed labs following deep cuts across federal agencies, cuts that were partly premised on objections to DEI. All of this has prompted college presidents to take another look at the ideas that Allen and her allies have long promoted. Call it pluralism pivot, a desire for a new paradigm that might ward off skeptical politicians and heal the bad vibes that have plagued higher ed. Though many college presidents were already trying to fix the cultural problems on their campuses, their hands may soon be forced by policymakers. Some of the universities that have most fully embraced pluralism are in politically purple or red states, such as Utah, where legislators have been moving to stamp out DEI. I'm sorry, deeply, profoundly sad and sorry that our sector had to start its reconsideration under these kinds of circumstances, Allen told me. That said, I'm glad to see that the pluralism concepts and frameworks are getting traction. As recently as a few years ago, the University of Utah, the state's flagship public school, which has about 36,000 students, seemed eager to advertise its progressive bona fides. In a 2022 issue of the Alumni Magazine, a feature on Taylor Randall, the recently installed president of the U, as people call it, listed some books he recommended, including Ibram X. Kendi, How to Be an Anti-Racist. A web extra detailed the history of the U's Black Cultural Center, which its then director described as trying to fight anti-blackness through a pan-African lens. Letters to the editor praised a profile of an alum who performs as the ice skating drag queen Denali Fox. That's our girl out here slaying. Race and gender-focused centers had opened in the late 1960s and early 70s, and the first administrator in charge of diversity was appointed in 1983. But the university's DEI efforts, known at the school as EDI, with the equity and diversity switched, accelerated in 2015. University leaders held a campus-wide dialogue on the racial climate, which led to extra money for ethnicity-related student groups, an effort to hire more minority faculty members, and an office to respond to racial microaggressions. The university created a new college, the School for Cultural and Social Transformation, nicknamed Transform. Transform was the Left Humanities College, as one professor put it, whereas another college served as the centrist humanities school. This effectively created a siloed ecosystem in which the most progressive professors would teach the most progressive students who worked with the most progressive staff members. Catherine Bond Stockton, a professor of English and critical theory, helped to create Transform and served as the chief diversity officer for the U's main campus. She had come to Utah in 1987 from Brown. I just remember saying to myself, "I don't think the East Coast or the West Coast needs me," she said. It was exciting to come to a place where I knew there would be a lot of disagreement with me and my views. Stockton, who is gay, was an evangelical throughout her teens and 20s and felt that she could relate to the religious people even if they might reject her sexuality. "The queerest thing about me is that I love Utah," she said. Stockton recalled a 2023 event put on by the Young America for Freedom, a conservative campus group. Local education activists were invited to make their case against DEI's gender ideology and critical race theory, or CRT. Stockton, along with a group of other faculty and students, protested outside in the rain before the event. "I don't know that anybody saw us or anybody heard us," she said. Still, she went to the lecture and later spoke to a group of women who had seemed excited about the talk so that she could better understand their perspective. "I have lived my whole life in such an impossible set of circumstances, not being gendered in the way that I want and not being able to love the people I want to love, that I feel that there's work I want to do," she said. And yet she also emphasized that others might feel uncomfortable engaging with views they might find offensive and dehumanizing. "I never recommend this as a general principle," she said. Stockton was a both willing to engage with people who didn't agree with her worldview, but also keen to protect students whom she saw as vulnerable. When Mary Ann Villarea arrived at the U in 2019 to serve in the newly created role of vice president for EDI, she noticed that the university was most responsive to students and staff who sought out conflict. The way that people got what they wanted was they pushed demands and resources were allocated in that way, she said. The school's cultural centers were designed to offer camaraderie and support to students from similar backgrounds, but they largely weren't set up to address the needs of rural students or Latter-day Saints, commonly known as Mormons, although the church has discouraged that term. Some secular faculty from out of state have historically taken a defensive posture toward the church, which is headquartered in Salt Lake City, punching up against the dominant conservative religious group, even though Latter-day Saints are a religious minority in the United States. Clark Ivory, a church member who was previously the chair of the U's Board of Trustees, has served on search committees for high-ranking academic leadership positions. He told me, "While it was never spoken, you knew that a candidate who was from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was going to have an uphill climb." Eboo Patel, the founder and president of Interfaith America, an organization that fosters pluralism on campuses, told me that the U's rank and file seemed enthusiastic about racial diversity, gender diversity, and cultural diversity, but not religious diversity. "That is pretty normal among lefty, student-facing staff because religion is framed principally as being anti-LGBT," he said. The mid-level staff were just intransigent. Villarreal wanted to make EDI less insulated. "Their idea of diversity was, can I have one of each?" she said. That was the university's way of being. She built relationships with leaders at the Institute, a center for LDS students near campus. She proactively pushed to revamp the space for Black and Latino students, trying to anticipate their needs rather than waiting for students to complain. She talked about a culture of connection as the North Star of EDI. In the fall of 2023, she got a hint that the school's EDI work might be in trouble. Nationally, protests over Israel and Gaza were roiling campuses. The discourse about DEI had reached a fever pitch, with conservatives claiming that it was a vehicle for indoctrination. Versions of these battles were playing out at the U. A Latino student group, Micha, blocked the entrance to a film screening about transgender kids who had detransitioned, hosted by the Young Americans for Freedom. Later, when the university sent a letter revoking its sponsorship of Micha, the club's members staged a protest at one of the school's cultural centers, reportedly waving a Palestinian flag and refusing to leave. Villarreal learned that state legislators were working on an anti-DEI bill. She put together an inventory, every dollar her office spent, every outcome achieved. It was meant to prove the worth of what the staff was doing, but Villarreal also understood that it might be a death document, a memorialization of work that was coming to an end. Utah has long been deep red politically, but moderate temperamentally. Mitt Romney, as a U.S. senator from Utah, was one of the few elected Republicans who didn't show unwaveringly fealty to Trump. In late 2020, following the murder of George Floyd, a number of Utah leaders, including the incoming Republican governor, Spencer Cox, signed on to the Utah Compact on Racial Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. The compact stated that racism is a system of ideas, beliefs, practices, structures, and policies which requires bold anti-racist actions to unravel. The signers affirmed that our commitment will not be just a passing moment, but a legacy movement of social, racial, and economic justice. But by 2023, Cox signaled a change in attitude on DEI. He called diversity statements essentially a pledge from job candidates to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, awful, bordering on evil. Randall, the school's president, agreed to reevaluate its diversity practices and prohibited the use of diversity statements in hiring. It didn't matter. In early 2024, two legislators introduced a wide-ranging bill, HB 261, the Equal Opportunity Initiatives, which would rein in DEI practices across Utah. Among other things, the legislation banned diversity trainings and offices and banned universities from promoting the idea that people are inherently privileged, oppressed, racist, sexist, oppressive, or a victim because of their race or gender. One of the bill's authors, Representative Katie Hall, spoke of receiving letters from professors who described themselves as lifelong liberals. There is a tension amongst faculty and administrators regarding the mission and role of the university, one wrote. There are those who perceive it to be the production of knowledge, and there are those who have shifted to seeing the role as that of social justice. The two approaches are not compatible. Keith Grover, the bill's Senate sponsor, said he had received complaints from three students in Utah who were turned away from tutoring services, academic advising, and a club because they were not racial minorities. Dozens of Utahns lined up to comment on the bill. Supporters were just as likely to be racial minorities as they were to be white. A defector from China, for example, called DEI a dangerous weapon in the hands of biased educators. The bill's critics, however, questioned the legislators' motives. One public university educator suggested that the bill's purpose was to have a chilling effect on higher education professionals and for us to question what we are and aren't supposed to be doing. Virtually none of the comments were narrow assessments of particular DEI programs. The people of Utah were grappling with much bigger questions, whether race and gender should define them and their friendships and communities, why some people in the country feel muzzled and excluded, whether DEI is a useful way to account for America's sins of discrimination. When people watched the testimonies, they started to realize, what in the world have we done? John Johnson, a conservative legislator, told me. I asked him why some of the signers of the Utah Compact had, just a few years later, come to support an anti-DEI bill. I firmly believe the people in Utah, our governor, they had the best of intentions. There was a real desire to improve race relations, he said, but people could see how far things have shifted. HB 261 passed in January 2024 and was signed into law by Governor Cox. This winter, I visited the Utah State House and met with Hall, the bill's author, in her office. An American flag and an elk skull were mounted on the wall. A hat on a shelf read, "Make the Great Salt Lake Great Again," Hall told me. Diversity is a beautiful word. Everybody wants that. Inclusion, we want that, but we don't want that to the point of exclusion. On a campus, when you have just race or identity-based places, you become in this bubble, she said. Ann Milner, a state senator, told me, "This feels like a pendulum that we're swinging. We were separate but equal, and then it was open access to everyone. And then there was this swing back to more separating. I think the pendulum is moving back a little bit." Before she got elected to the legislature, Milner served as the president of Weber State, a university with nearly 30,000 students in Ogden, Utah. Many of them are parents or full-time workers or the first in their family to go to college. Milner felt that student services shouldn't just focus on race and gender. They should offer everyone the support they need to put their heads down and get a degree. She and others touted the same initial stat about HB 261 success. After the bill was passed, Weber State opened the Student Success Center, which offers things like advising and workshops on personal finances to all students. More than 1,000 students visited in the fall of 2024. The previous fall, only 450 students had shown up at 7 different race, ethnicity, and gender-focused cultural centers combined. Grover, the Senate sponsor, told me that he sees Utah as a national leader on this issue. "The country has definitely moved on DEI," he said. "This is where we're going now." It seems like in every generation, conservatives have questioned the role of gender and race on campus, whether they're focused on women's liberation or affirmative action or CRT. In recent years, however, the most significant shift has happened, not on the right, but in the center and on the left, as leaders who once embraced DEI have come to doubt the way it has been carried out. Patel, the Interfaith American president who describes himself as an Obama liberal, blames the backlash on the anti-oppression strain of DEI, which emphasizes the marginalization of minority groups. For it to prove itself right, it has to define minorities as people who are principally victims of something, he said. He describes events with students that felt like Communist Party meetings, where young people were unable to see themselves as anything but oppressed. There's no college president who wants classrooms to become Communist Party meetings. In 2022, Raj Venkakota, a friend of Patel's and the president of an organization called the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, started talking with college presidents about the unease they felt on their campuses. They worried that their perspectives at their schools had become too narrow, and that their students didn't understand how to engage with opposing viewpoints. Higher education had become polarized, with the college degree serving as a reliable predictor of how someone might vote. People had come to view higher education as a private good, Venkakota told me. It's easy for politicians to vilify college when the point of it is to adopt the right ideas and get ahead rather than to become a productive member of society. There is a public good responsibility that is being lost, that is being devalued, that is being deprioritized, Venkakota told me. In August 2023, he launched a new initiative, College Presidents for Civic Preparedness. A few months later, Hamas fighters invaded Israel, initiating a war. On campuses, the floodgates open, Venkakota told me. 123 presidents are now in the group and have committed to protecting open debate and free inquiry. Rosalind Artis, the president of Benedict College, an HBCU in South Carolina, told me that the goal is to take on the PR problem in education, which generally is born of this perception that we are biased, we are liberal, that we are producing little anarchists. In 2019, artists hosted Trump on campus. I nearly died over it, politically and otherwise, she said. Benedict is about 80% Black, and 84% of students come from low-income families. Artist believes she has a responsibility to expose students to views they might not like. I am anti-safe space, she said. It is our students who have to assimilate. The world does not assimilate to them. But Lori White, the Black president of DePauw, a majority white liberal arts school in Indiana, who also joined the coalition, was careful to note that philosophical discussions about freedom of expression go only so far. As a student, she said, if I'm in an argument with you and you say something controversial that I feel like somehow compromises my humanity, it's really hard for me to hear. I'm not yet mature enough sometimes to be able to accept that. In this charged political moment, college presidents have mixed motives for waving their hands in the air in favor of free expression. It's not just Trump's crackdown. Legislatures around the country are considering anti-DEI bills along the lines of Utah's. Texas and Florida have already placed even stricter limits on academic content seen as bias or indoctrinating. When I asked Michael S. Roth, the president of Wesleyan University, whether presidents are flocking toward pluralism because they're afraid of being hit with a lawsuit, he laughed. They're entirely that, he said. 100%. What else would they be? People are afraid, as they should be. Still, to see the pluralism pivot entirely as an exercise in covering your ass would miss the depth of the soul-searching that college presidents are doing. Especially after Trump's election, presidents feel lied to by their diversity experts, Patel told me. For years, college administrators claimed that minority groups felt literally endangered by the ideas of Trump and his allies. And yet, to take just one example, roughly 50% of Latinos under the age of 40 voted for him. It's like, you're just wrong, Patel said. You're like a dentist that pulled the wrong tooth. A few months after HB 261 passed, Villarreal, the U's VP of EDI, left the school for another job. It was disappointing, she said. I really struggled with the question of where I had failed to cross some bridges. She had wanted to turn diversity work at the U into something bigger than racial box checking. It was a failed vision on my part, she said. Perhaps the banner under which she was working, the campus diversity movement, no longer serves the purpose it was meant to. A movement that had always focused on making people feel that they belong had become associated with division and exclusion. The acronym in the word, there's no win on it, she said. There's no win in claiming DEI. Let's just be clear about what we're doing. As with so much of the debate over DEI and free expression, HB 261 is largely about language. It prohibits state-funded universities from using the phrase diversity, equity, and inclusion for offices or trainings. It requires professors to enter their course titles and syllabi in public databases, presumably so that others can see how they describe their lessons. Leaders at the U put out a guidance document for staff that reads a bit like instructions for the board game Taboo, in which the goal is to describe a word without actually saying it. You're listening to The New Yorker Magazine, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. The document advises avoiding interview questions about working with a diverse team, for instance, swapping that for a question with working with people from backgrounds that are different from your own. Before the law was passed, the university sponsored and funded a half dozen race and ethnicity-based student groups. These groups were told that they, too, had to comply with the new law. The Black Student Union, for example, could not take public positions on concepts like anti-racism or intersectionality. Nearly all the student groups decided that the bureaucratic compliance wasn't worth the effort and gave up their sponsored status. Alex Takeda, a senior who serves as president of the Asian American Student Association, one of the formerly sponsored groups, told me, "There's a lot of disappointment and feelings of helplessness. All these things are being taken away without anybody to really talk to about it." Several of the school's identity-related cultural centers have also shut down. This winter, another student leader who asked not to be named because she was worried about being targeted by ICE took me on a tour of the student union, which is being rearranged to comply with the law. We visited what had once been the Center for Equity and Student Belonging. She led me to the back of an office where men were assembling furniture next to a stack of moving boxes. The walls were blank. Administrators had recently removed artwork depicting 8 female activists, including Angela Davis, the Marxist prison abolitionist, and Grace Lee Boggs, the Asian American Black Power activist. "This is where we used to always congregate," she said. "Now it's less clear whether students are welcome. Not that they'd have much of a place to sit." We walked past the old LGBT Resource Center, which had been replaced by the catch-all Center for Community and Cultural Engagement. It hosted programs celebrating MLK Day and planned to hold events for Pride Week, both allowed under the new law. "It's a little bit confusing," she said. "The center share awareness of the different cultures that are represented here on campus without talking about the adversities. So it's more performative." When I asked whether she had gone to the event, she shrugged. "I don't engage with them as much," she said. Nearby was another center with an impossible-to-remember generic name, the Center for Student Access and Resources. The director, Kristen Monum, used to run the Women's Resource Center. The new center's acronym, CSAR, was pasted on an otherwise blank wall. "Students have observed that it feels like a dentist's office," Monum said. Later that afternoon, I met a student named Sadie Werner. She had been the president of the Black Student Union when HB 261 passed and quit out of frustration over the new rules. "I have shed way too many tears over this bill," she said. She used to hang out at the Black Cultural Center, where students could reliably find programming, friends, and free food. Now she said the space is locked. Werner heard that one of her scholarships, which had been administered by the center, was being eliminated, sending her into a panic about how to pay for school. It turned out that no scholarships had been eliminated, but they had been distributed among several different offices. Werner said she hadn't heard about how to reapply. Grief over the end of the used cultural centers has gone far beyond students and staff. The Democratic minority leaders in the Utah House and Senate, Angela Romero and Luz Escamilla, both went to the University of Utah. They met at what was then known as the Center for Ethnic Student Affairs. In 1997, there was hardly anyone with black hair in Utah, Escamilla told me. "The center really helped us feel that we belonged at the University of Utah." The fact that both she and Romero came through the same program and ended up as leaders in the legislature speaks volumes, she said. Romero told me, "If it wasn't for the Center for Ethnic Student Affairs, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. I am a product of DEI, and I am okay with that." Even after a year, the passage of the law, Escamilla couldn't understand what it was trying to achieve. "I don't know how erasing someone's identity is getting you closer to collaboration," she said. "I was trying to understand, why is this bothering you? How could this be harming you, that kids have a way of belonging?" Escamilla's district in Salt Lake is predominantly working class and Latino. "It was so heartbreaking to me that the kids in my neighborhood, my district, the children I represent, it was us fighting for them and no one else," she said. When the university announced that it would be closing the Women's Resource Center, Madam took down the art that hung on the walls. She loaded a couple of pieces into her car and returned them to the former staff members who had donated them. She and her colleagues organized a farewell party at a brewery. They wore t-shirts with the center's logo. They took Polaroid selfies. They wrote love letters to what their community had been. The pictures and notes sit in a small cardboard box on a shelf above Monum's computer. She meant to take them to the university archives, but she hadn't been able to bring herself to do so. "I take them down and read them," she told me. "Some days I cry. Inside the box, stickers decorated with groovy flowers and WRC. In 1970-style font, note the dates of the center's founding and closure, like an obituary. 1971 to 2024. The big question for the pluralism paradigm is whether it will eventually go the same way as DEI, becoming a target for lawsuits and culture war backlash. The intellectual framework of pluralism seems legally sturdier than that of DEI, which focuses on certain aspects of identity in a way that arguably runs afoul of America's civil rights laws. The Supreme Court recently banned race-conscious admissions, for example, and many colleges have moved to end race-specific scholarships after facing legal challenges. By contrast, pluralism emphasizes everyone's ability to thrive, with all their differences fully respected. It's less clear how pluralism will land politically, though, in the Trumpian moment. A strong movement for pluralism on campuses, largely spearheaded by liberals, was well underway before Trump was elected. The coterie of scholars and consultants who are pushing pluralism are all deeply worried that their work will be construed as yet another leftist program of indoctrination, or now that Trump is cracking down on DEI, mistrusted by academics as capitulation to the regime. It's important that this work does not get co-opted as just a conservative thing or a liberal thing. Manu Miel, the head of Bridge USA, a network of student groups that hosts conversations about controversial topics, told me, "It has to be an American thing." The philanthropic sector may or may not follow the pluralism pivot. Michael Murray, the president of Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, which fund projects in higher education and religion, told me that since October 7th, things have changed quite a bit in terms of available philanthropic dollars. High net worth individuals have made it clear that they are willing to put their resources on the line for institutions to do work in this space. Jennifer Hoos-Rothberg, the executive director of the Einhorn Collaborative, a nonprofit philanthropy, has put together a group of funders who she says want to take pluralism work from nice to have, soft, squishy, to tangible, measurable, meaningful, and sustainable. Even traditional philanthropists in higher education are poking around pluralism. Terry Taylor, a strategy director at the Lumina Foundation, a heavyweight funder with $1.5 billion in assets, told me that a group of 20 organizations joined a call in December after Trump's re-election to trade notes on efforts to foster dialogue on campuses. Still, the foundation, which has historically focused on equity, is leery of abandoning its emphasis on racial justice. Race is, in many ways, a superseding factor, Jamie Maristosis, Luminous CEO, told me. Being a person of color, being Black, or being someone who comes from an underrepresented ethnic group, like Latinos, leads to poorer outcomes. He sees the turn away from DEI as a response to its politicalization. To walk away from the construct of race or ethnicity, he said, means our collective talent as a nation will suffer. The most stalwart DEI advocates see the criticism of current DEI practices as cover for racism. Paulette Granberry Russell, the president of the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education, said of legislators who oppose DEI, "The real interest is in obliterating efforts that provide support for particular communities. It's been 2 years of trying to get a message across that this work is not divisive, it's not discrimination, it's not exclusion or indoctrination." She added, "Don't let them get away with saying it's divisive." At a place like the University of Utah, these debates are largely theoretical. HB 261 is the law, and the school must move forward. I met with Taylor Randall, the president, in his office. He has been working with Patel, the Interfaith America president, along with others, to develop a pluralistic vision for the U. not as a repackaged form of DEI, but as a new version, based on cooperation across difference. Randall has a scholarly background in accounting, and his attraction to pluralism is fittingly pragmatic. A market economy functions on relationships and transactions, which naturally require compromise and coalition building, he said. Helping students find common ground is the most practical skill I can teach. Students need to learn how to state and debate their views, he added. It's one of the critical skills we've got to have as citizens. The U is starting to roll out new initiatives. In addition to Patel, the school has brought in Arthur Brooks, a Harvard professor and a self-styled happiness guru, and Timothy Shriver, the chairman of the Special Olympics, as impact scholars, who regularly visit the campus. There are scholarships for students who do service projects with one another, faculty and students who pitch ideas for collaborating across lines of differences will be eligible for grants. We're in the early stages to see whether this framework is going to work or not, Randall said. One of the U's efforts is centered on religious inclusion. Interfaith America has conducted bridge builder trainings in which students learn techniques for careful listening and facilitating difficult conversations. The U's leaders are also focused on trying to change the school's reputations for being unfriendly toward LDS students. To boost enrollment, the school is recruiting from the fastest growing counties in the state, including the heavily LDS area around Provo, where Brigham Young University is situated. Over the past couple of years, Clark Ivory, the former board chair, has led a project to open standards housing for students who agree not to drink or do drugs or house overnight guests. It's not explicitly marketed as LDS housing, but he told me it will provide those students with a place where they can come and be very safe. It was a surprising echo of a DEI idea that students should feel safe in their identities and that their safety comes from being surrounded by others who share the same values. Randall's pluralism initiatives look different in the context of the U's recruitment efforts. They could be read as a bid to make the university seem more palatable to the conservative audience it is intentionally courting. Still, there's significant suspicion on the right about pluralism, that it's just a new word for the expectation that conservatives will compromise on their convictions in public spaces. On a recent evening, a few hundred students gathered at the Institute, the church's center beside the U's campus. The building is huge, with multiple social halls and two basketball courts. There was an elaborate dodgeball tournament happening. Many students had arrived earlier for a panel with InterVarsity, an evangelical group, and classes about LDS theology. Troy Virgin, the Institute's director, told me that 3,000 students are enrolled in classes there, a number that's been rising steadily. I met with a few students in one of the classrooms. Gideon Kipiban, a student at the U, told me that most of his friends had gone to Brigham Young, but that attending the U had helped him to take ownership of his faith. When you're surrounded by your own people, you go with the flow, he said. For me, I have to make that choice to come to the Institute or go to church. The students were only dimly aware of HB 261. Kipabani, who is Laotian, was the sole non-white student in the room. He was also the only person who had visited one of the cultural centers. The other students didn't need to. At the Institute, they had found a home for people like them. A junior named Eliza Stewart remembered, as a freshman, coming in feeling very intimidated and overwhelmed by college and being an adult. This, she told me, was a safe space. By Emma Green. Emma Green is a staff writer at The New Yorker who covers education and academia. Department of Labor. How to survive the AI revolution. The Luddites lost the fight to save their livelihood. As the threat of artificial intelligence looms, can we do any better? By John Cassidy. In the early hours of April 12, 1812, a crowd of men approached the Raffolds Mill, a four-story stone building on the banks of the River Spen in West Yorkshire. This was Bronte country, a landscape of bleak moors, steep valleys, and small towns nestled in the hollows. The men who'd assembled on the moors hours earlier were armed with muskets, sticks, hatchets, and heavy blacksmith's hammers. When they reached the mill, those at the front broke windows to gain entry, and some fired shots into the darkened factory. But the mill's owner, William Cartwright, had been preparing for trouble. During the previous 12 months, a wave of attacks had swept through textile factories across central and northern Europe, England. The unrest began in Nottinghamshire, where stocking knitters stormed their employers' premises and destroyed newfangled knitting frames, which they blamed for undercutting wages and reducing them to penury. These attacks spread to Lancashire, the heart of textile manufacturing, and to Yorkshire, where mill owners had begun mechanizing the ancient craft of dressing woolen cloth, raising the nap and cutting it into finished pieces. For centuries, the shearers or croppers who practiced this craft had formed something like an artisanal priesthood, raising the nap with the heads of teasel plants and finishing the cloth with handheld shears in a ritual of skill passed from father to son. Now came the machines, the gig mills with their cold metal rollers, and the shearing frames that needed just one man turning a crank like an organ grinder, playing a funeral march for an entire way of life. Cartwright had been staying in the mill overnight with employees and armed reservists from the Cumberland Militia, one of the many military units dispatched to centers of unrest. When the attack began, reservists opened fire while Cartwright's men dropped rocks from the roof. Taken by surprise by the forceful resistance, the crowd quickly dispersed, leaving behind two seriously wounded young men who died within 48 hours. At the inquest, a coroner issued a verdict of justifiable homicide. In January 1813 at York Castle, 14 croppers stood trial for rioting and machine breaking, which Parliament had deemed a capital offense in the new Frame Breaking Act. The court discharged some defendants but found 5 guilty. In other trials, 9 more men were convicted. On January 16th, Yorkshire's executioner hanged 14 condemned men. "I do not think any of them had a proper sense of the crime they died for," one witness recounted. It isn't clear where the term Luddite originated. Some accounts trace it to Ned Ludd, a textile worker who reported smashing a knitting frame in 1779. Others suggest that it may derive from folk memories of King Ludica, a 9th-century Anglo-Saxon monarch who died in battle. Whatever the source, many machine breakers identified General Ludd as their leader. A couple of weeks after the Rawfolds attack, William Horsfall, another mill owner, was shot dead. A letter sent after Horsfall's assassination, which hailed the avenging of the death of the two brave youths who fell at the siege of Rawfolds, began by order of General Ludd. The British government, at war with Napoleon, regarded the Luddites as Jacobean insurrectionists and responded with brutal suppression. But this reaction stemmed from a fundamental misinterpretation. Far from being revolutionary, Luddism was a defensive response to the industrial capitalism that was threatening skilled workers' livelihoods. The Luddites weren't mindless opponents of technology, but had a clear logic to the actions, an essentially conservative one. Since they had no political representation until 1867, the British voting franchise excluded the vast majority, they concluded that violent protest was their only option. The burning of factories or setting fire to the property of people we know is not right, but starvation forces nature to do that which he would not, one Yorkshire cropper wrote. "We have tried every effort to live by pawning our cloths and chattels, so we are now on the brink for the last struggle." As alarm about artificial intelligence has gone global, so has a fascination with the Luddites. The British podcast, the Ned Ludd Radio Hour, describes itself as your weekly dose of tech skepticism, cynicism, and absurdism. Kindred themes are explored in the podcast, This Machine Kills, co-hosted by the social theorist Jathan Sadowski, whose new book, The Mechanic and the Luddite, argues that the fetishization of AI and other digital technologies obscures their role in disciplining labor and reinforcing a profit-driven system. Luddites want technology, the future, to work for all of us, he told The Guardian. The technology journalist Brian Merchant makes a similar case in Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech, 2023, blending a vivid account of the original Luddites with an indictment of contemporary tech giants like Amazon and Uber. Merchant portrays the current wave of automation as part of a centuries-long struggle over labor and power. Working people are staring down entrepreneurs, tech monopolies, and venture capital firms that are hunting for new forms of labor-saving tech, be it AI, robotics, or software automation, to replace them, Merchant writes. They are again faced with losing their jobs to the machine. Warnings about AI's impact on employment have been amplified by studies predicting mass job displacement, including in white-collar fields once thought immune to automation. A widely cited McKinsey report, updated in 2024, estimates that technologies like generative AI have the potential to automate work activities that absorb up to 70% of employees' time today. An earlier Goldman Sachs analysis projected that generative AI could put the equivalent of 300 million full-time jobs at risk worldwide. One profession already seeing steep losses is computer programming, at which AI has proved especially adept. U.S. government data indicate that more than a quarter of all programming jobs have disappeared in the past 2 years. For a time, the standard economic view of AI was more optimistic. Historically, economists have associated major technological breakthroughs, such as the steam engine and electrification, with productivity growth that, in the long term, raises living standards. In the second machine age, 2014, the MIT economists Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee argued that AI and robotics could play a role akin to that of the steam engine. The key building blocks are already in place for digital technologies to be as important and transformational to society and the economy. All that time, generative AI was still in its infancy. But in an article published in May 2023, about 6 months after OpenAI released ChatGPT to the public, Brynjolfsson and his colleague Martin Bailey and Anton Korenek described how one of them had used the chatbot to accelerate research. After he encountered a few plain English prompts, the system was able to provide a suitable economic model, draft code to run the model, and produce potential titles for the work. By the end of the morning, he had achieved a week's worth of progress on his research. Raising economists' productivity might not significantly affect the broader world, but the authors highlighted potential benefits across multiple disciplines, including mechanical engineering, material science, chemistry, and robotics. If cognitive workers are more efficient, they will accelerate technical progress and thereby boost the rate of productivity growth in perpetuity, they wrote. Their paper included a chart showing how AI could potentially double labor productivity and GDP within 20 years under an optimistic scenario. The economists acknowledged that a bigger pie does not automatically mean everyone benefits evenly or at all, and cited studies on AI's automation potential. Still drawing lessons from previous technological transformations, they suggested that displaced workers would eventually find new employment. Job destruction has always been offset by job creation. Recently, however, some prominent economists have offered darker perspectives. Darren Acemoglu, an MIT economist and a Nobel laureate, told MIT News in December that AI was being used too much for automation and not enough for providing expertise and information to workers. In a subsequent article, he acknowledged AI's potential to improve decision-making and productivity, but warned that it would be detrimental if it ceaselessly eliminates tasks and jobs, over-centralizes information, and discourages human inquiry and experiential learning, empowers a few companies to rule over our lives, and creates a two-tier society with vast inequalities and status differences. In such a scenario, AI may even destroy democracy and human civilization as we know it. Acemoglu cautioned, I fear this is the direction we are heading in. The Luddites grasped an essential truth. The factory system threatened their artisanal economy and livelihoods. This transformation was most dramatic in cotton manufacturing, as exemplified in Murray's Mills in Manchester's Ancoats neighborhood, a vast operation with 8-story buildings, steam engines, and more than 1,200 workers. Visitors flocked to see the complex, which represented the new economy of its day. And that's all we have time for today. By John Cassidy. John Cassidy has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1995. He writes The Financial Page, a column about economics and politics. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.